And a very good morning, 10:01 a.m. here in the Sonoran Desert in Phoenix, Arizona. This is Gabe at FPL Lens. You are watching or listening to the Game Week 16 Net That Haul matchups review show. We've been away for a little while because of the game weeks in quick succession, but happy to be back here with our resident insight expert for reviews. And that's Lucien at teacher_FPL. How are you this very late night on your end of the planet?
Oh, you flattered me, Gabe. I'd love to give as much insight as possible. And there's so much to say. There's absolutely so much to say because so many of these teams have so many things changing about them. And it is as delightful as it is frustrating, especially for our FPL teams, which I shall not talk about today. So let's go.
Right on. And you said it is eventful. K7 in the chat here saying, coming in, evening chaps, eventful game week, lots of great games and shock results. Shock results and shock just happening. So we're going to get right into it. So we stay under the 1 hour mark. L. Ron Carbert also joining us in the chat. The most magical time of the year. Maybe he's talking about black magic. I don't know. Let's see. Just a quick review. Obviously, game week 16. Here's the overall kind of the metrics, and we're looking at, and the reason I really wanted to include this slide today was because Fulham had the highest net XG of the game week and scored the most goals. Now, I wouldn't have predicted Fulham to score the most goals this game week, but I thought it was really interesting that NetXG has actually, Fulham has been at the top for two or three weeks now, like near the top. So NetXG is really seeing something there. I'm really keen to see, to hear what you have to say on Fulham. And I know Colm Bugler will also be very keen, our resident Fulham fan. Nice to see some people joining us in the chat. Already said hello to Elron and K7. Ilgianis is coming in, say FPL's best duo. Thank you very much. Continuing with the flattery, it is a season of flattery. So thank you. That means a lot to us. But I'm here to listen to you, Lucien, because I don't know if I just want to get this out there. I don't know if I've said it, and if I have said it, maybe I haven't said it enough. It's been going on, I don't know. Definitely over a year where I've been using your reviews to help inform my matchups articles. And I don't know if everybody actually knows that, how much I rely on them, be it when you were doing the podcasts or the threads you write, or obviously I'm a subscriber to your Patreon, so I read your Patreon articles. And I would say the majority of my influence, my outside influence comes from you. So nobody influences me more than you do. I value your insight, and I know the people in the chat do as well. With that said, talk to us. Crystal Palace versus Liverpool here. I'm going to bring the stats up while you get it going. I'm a little bit late to the draw here, but go ahead. Why don't you get us started, and then I'll chime in with some of the stats.
All right. Merry Christmas, everybody. Very early Christmas. As Liverpool, well, at least they are the one side that is reliably giving us results. Because Liverpool, right? I think there were a few key matchups that we were all very, very interested in. Number one, we all love to target Joel Ward on the right side. And I think that was probably the reason a lot of us targeted Luis Diaz. And I think it has to be said now that targeting Joel Ward has a lot more nuance to this because, number one, if you want to have somebody actually go one-on-one against the fullback, he has to be in the box. If you take him on outside the box, the influence is actually minimal. And this was what happened here with Luis Diaz, where he actually engaged Joel Ward like pretty much on the edge of the penalty area, and he would cut inside and shoot from there. And that basically came with very underwhelming results. So instead, it was the other flank that developed as things went on, because Liverpool right now, right, as we all know, they are a team that starts mediocre and then they grow in strength right after half time. And one key substitution that they've been making here is starting with Wataru Endo in DM, and then they shift Trent Alexander-Arnold into midfield. And that, as the game progresses, makes Salah way more dangerous than he should be. Because, well, number one, Liverpool need results because they've been pretty underwhelming themselves. And at the same time, well, Salah just gets better partners. And it's just such a shame that you've highlighted Szoboszlai exactly in the space between the lines. And it just happens to be Gakpo in that exact same position where Szoboszlai goes to the left. So,
and Harvey Elliott, who gets the goal from that position.
Yes, exactly that. It's such a shame. Yeah, correct space, just wrong personnel. And I think that is a huge reflection of our process of looking at Liverpool, right? We all want to try and gang up on the people that Salah works with. People think that Salah creates with Diaz. People think that Salah works with Szoboszlai down the right side alongside Trent. But really, Salah could work with literally anybody because Klopp rotates the supporting cast so much that it could be anybody from Jones on the left to Elliot on the right to Szoboszlai or Trent on the left one game to Gakpo on the right. It just rotates and changes all the time. And the only constant in all of this is Darwin Nunes missing big chance after big chance. So, yeah, I'm going to talk about Darwin here. I think more interesting thing that comes out of this, right, is how to target Crystal Palace. Because Crystal Palace now are without their defensive linchpin, Jordan Ayew. And, right, they play Man City up next, right? So, the slides that you've put up says that, yeah, we're trying to expect Richards and Lerma getting pinned back, right? Because, with that back four, what Hodgson did, right, despite having Ayew sent off, is that he just kept that Mars bar of four defenders each. And he just let it be. He refused to track attackers all the way until the end of the second half, where I think it was Gehi that tracked Gakpo out of position, and Richards had to make a very difficult position. Richards was in a very difficult position, choosing between tracking other runners or just filling in Gehi's space. So this is where we look at Man City and we go, if Haaland is out for the Crystal Palace game, who do we pick up? Is it going to be a Bernardo Silva? Or is it going to be Phil Foden who fills in that space? Because it comes down to whether you perceive the City Palace game as an easy game where City win 5-0 or a difficult game that we saw against Luton where, you know, eventually a certain hero such as Rodri would bomb into the box and make the difference. So in this particular case, yeah, if you expect a City blowout, this is a perfect Phil Foden game. But if you expect Palace to just stay defensive and struggle until the 90th minute, then this is basically a Rodri / Bernardo Silva game. So that's the implication from the Palace defensive aspect of it.
Right. I don't think I have any questions on this one, honestly. I did think that another thing that I mentioned, I thought Richards was at fault there for, like, he didn't... you know, he didn't track well there either. So so that could be a weakness, an identified weakness there. In these different Liverpool setups, right? Having a different player in center mid, having different player like running between the lines, do you identify or have you identified what works best in what situations, or is that just still kind of like a work in progress where we need more information to see what works best?
Oh no, I think three games are enough. I think the last three games that Liverpool played, right, have been against varying types of different defenses. So against Palace here, who are considered structured, right, you're looking at teams that will overload the flanks and, you know, will make complicated movements such as Elliot and Salah and whatnot. But if, let's say, you're going to play against a team that is relatively simple, such as Sheffield United, right? Then you are looking at someone that roams literally all over the pitch, like Trent Alexander-Arnold, to do the damage. So instead of looking at matchups based on zones, whenever you invest in a Liverpool player, you're looking at the type of opponents they put up. Do they have a set structure of defense put up where you need to rely on overloads or rotations to get past them, or are they just error prone and you just need a really quality moment somewhere on the flanks or through the center of the pitch that just breaks through? So yeah, I mean, I'm looking at Liverpool's next few fixtures. It's like United, Arsenal and Burnley. These are teams that depend on winning the ball in midfield, breaking past the initial wave of pressure and just bursting forward. So I'd say, okay, you know, you can rely on Trent and Salah and Darwin, you know, breaking down whatever spaces they have. Yeah, so it's going to be that sort of game.
Right on. Let's move on to the next one here. And I do have the stats now. I did here. Okay. Brighton versus Burnley. Brighton 1.78 net XG. Burnley 0.85. Obviously ended 1-1 with 2.78 XG for Brighton and 0.56 for Burnley. So Brighton showing a little bit of their Graham Potter selves with the XG team of the week. What did you see in this one?
Well, the problem here is that I think a lot of the XG was accumulated incredibly late on. I think we got to start with Burnley. Give them a little bit of credit for trying to shore up the Colioso-shaped hole with their backup equivalent of the Odobert, because he did pretty well. He did pretty well, given the platform to shine. But yes, Brighton. So I think the highlight of the last few games has been, you know, deploying midfielders at fullback. And, you know, since Gross did so well at left back, it was incredibly curious to see Gross start at right back this game while Milner played left back. So, yeah, Brighton were actually really underwhelming and Burnley deserved the lead, fully deserved the lead. So, yeah, they went back to type. Second half, they learned their lesson, switched Gross over to the left, brought Hinshelwood on to play right central mid. And it was basically all the XG from the left, cross to the right, cross to the right, cross to the right. Like, I literally have a graphic put up where Brighton do their thing of one forward occupying one centre-back or one defender, and Adingra is just there waiting on his own. Like, give the ball to me. And in like the last 10 minutes alone, right, I think Adingra racked up like humongous XG just by being free. If it's not him, it would be Hinshelwood breaking into the box, just getting huge headers. I mean, Ferguson had a chance or two, so your slide is correct in the sense that Ferguson is the tip of the spear. It's just such a shame that Ferguson shared the pitch with Joao Pedro. So Ferguson's influence was just subjected to the near post space he had compared to the far post space where the golden zone is, you know, for Gross's crosses. That's such a shame. Such a shame. Yeah, but beyond that, everything you said based on your slides are absolutely correct.
Nice one. And yeah, that Joao Pedro thing, obviously, if that's Mitoma, then Ferguson becomes more the tip of the spear, but with João Pedro in there, right? The positioning changes, and João Pedro obviously gets central a lot more than Mitoma. Mitoma's rest was just a needed rest because of fatigue, because of the close games, right? I mean, I'm hoping it's not tactical. I've seen in a couple of games where, I mean, this Burnley game, I don't know. Like, I get why you play Lallana. I get why you play Adingra. I'm a massive João Pedro fan. I don't know. Play speed running into space behind Burnley's packs central midfield, right? Instead of a hold up player to like Pedro, who I don't know. I think honestly that there's a lot of talk about that Serbia, about the good things he does, but I don't think he's received enough criticism for his tactics. I think his tactics have often been quite suspect. His choice of personnel has been suspect as well. He may call it rotation, but it's not like for like rotation, so there is a tactical element, and I think he deserves a little more criticism personally. Next match, Manchester United. Oh, I'm gonna enjoy this one, and then not because of Manchester United. Just Padna, don't get upset at me, please. This, I'm enjoying this one because of Bournemouth and Andoni Iraola, and just watching this team blossom has just been incredible. And I know not most people, probably FPL managers, don't watch La Liga, and they probably just remember Iraola from the last time when Athletic Bilbao beat Manchester United. I think it was 3-0 at Old Trafford as well. So that's probably how you know Iraola. But Solanke's back in the production. Stats are interesting, are much more even than the scoreline would suggest, although I don't I don't think the gameplay was that even. 1.16 for Manchester United, 1.48 for Bournemouth. Manchester United with 69% possession in a 3-0 loss with almost the same XG. 20 shots for Manchester United and 3 shots on target. And that might be the overarching statement here. Your turn. What do you see?
Well, I think let's get the... Well, I'm not going to say juxtaposition. I think the mocking scenery of this whole thing is that everything, whatever you put on your slide about Manchester United will be wrong forever. Because it is impossible to have any sense of reliability with Manchester United on any given day. So Garnacho, nope. In the end, it was Anthony and Reguilon working on the left side that bore fruit. Bruno, dangerous, somewhat. I think United are a side that relies on the crisis to deliver right now. So if things are fine, then they will crash. And when they crash, they will eventually deliver results. So, you know, I think we just happen to catch them at the crashing stage. And we might see them bounce back, you know, with results sometime in January or February. So, yeah, that's Man United for you. How, though, I really don't know. Because they are fielding Amrabat and McTominay in attacking midfield. You see them get into really advanced positions, but they receive so awkwardly because they just don't have that speed of thought ahead of time, right? You take up a risky position, you need to know that Iraola's defense of all teams is going to come after you. So, you know, you get into positions and that's good, but if your first touch is bad or if you just shield the ball the wrong way the moment the ball comes to you, like, yeah, Bournemouth will just eat you up. And I think the scariest bit about United is that when you take a risk, let's say Bruno Fernandes moves to the left side, Luke Shaw also opens up the space on the left, you leave this gaping hole in the middle and Solanke is just waiting there. Any early ball to Solanke or Semenyo basically made Bournemouth look dangerous. So Bournemouth didn't need possession at all. They just needed an opportunity. And that's United for you. I mean, this isn't the first time we've mentioned this because United have given the ball away in really awkward positions, especially without Casemiro, you know. But that's how United are, just lack of personnel in central midfield that can bring the ball forward, you know, instead of just playing the ball forward. But I think we're all more interested in Bournemouth, right? Because they play Luton next. Bournemouth play Luton next. So, where do we even begin? I mean, there's just so much excitement now, right? We're looking at Semenyo, Tavernier, Solanke. I mean, I think I've seen a few Ryan Christie names being put forth because of how expensive. I mean, Tavernier is the same price as Cole Palmer. And people are thinking, oh, you know what? Might be worth a shout. So, again, right? With Bournemouth, you're expecting Bournemouth to have very little possession, even though they're up against a Luton team. So, just go with the so-called matchups and figure out where Luton's weak side is. You know, we'll talk about Luton later on. I don't want to spend too much time on Bournemouth. But long story short, you are definitely targeting Bournemouth's right side. And there's a very high chance Semenyo starts and Tavernier might drift over later on. Yeah, I'll just keep it concise like that.
Even I still like Tavernier on quote unquote the weak side. I like his far post runs. He can still do that. But one quick thing on United that I noticed is Luke Shaw and Sergio Reguilon. And it is, and I do want to say, because thank you for pronouncing the L. There's just one L, so it's Reguilon, not Reguillon. That, and even on TV, I'm listening to it, and for some reason, they're not pronouncing the L. I'm sorry, these things kind of irk me because it doesn't take much to say the L, right? It just takes a little bit of like you're showing enough respect for the guy that you're going to see how to pronounce his name. I guess I get if it's difficult, no big deal. But so thank you for that. But Reguilon and Shaw played basically the same position. They were in the same areas of the field. I don't understand that. Bruno Fernandes, like you said, he played on the left, right? And who was Amrabat obviously was deeper than McTominay. McTominay had those bombs in the box like they do. But tactically, when you see this team play, they are in all the wrong positions. There are no options for them. They are so poorly set up. They, and I can't even, the execution is so bad And you can see it from the heat maps. You can see it from the average position maps. The execution is so bad. You have to put the blame on the manager here. The manager can't set up a team, can't organize a team. I think that they need to take a serious look at themselves and come to a decision. We'll get more into that 2 days from now, Wednesday, when we get into the full matchup show. But not to ridicule, like I'm looking for ways for United to be, honestly, for United to be better. Don't play two guys in the same position. Like there are so many things, right? So we'll get to that more tomorrow. But moving on to the next one here, it's Sheffield United against Brentford. I mean, Sheffield United did it, right? Bringing up the statistics here. Obviously, Sheffield United won, Brentford 0. Brian Mbeumo less Brentford, of course. We have Sheffield United 0.81 XG, Brentford only 0.66 XG, with a total of 19 total shots in this game. So not much there. Obviously, this isn't a game I saw. To be perfectly honest, I didn't even see the highlights of this game. I'm gonna just let you go if there's anything to say here.
No, what highlights? I mean, if you watch the highlights, it's pretty much shots from range, shots from range, shots from range. I think the disappointing thing is that Brentford didn't leverage on their traditional strengths of throw-ins and set pieces. So I think in that sense, perhaps it was Yanel that was missing here. Sorry, Jensen that was missing here. And instead of trying to go direct with their long throws, relying on Collins and Pinnock and whatnot, they just decided to play their game and rely on bursts forward from midfield. I think right now, Brentford are forced to play central midfielders on the flanks, right? As it is, Yanel is playing on the left, Guardas is playing on the right, and now we've got Baptiste showing up on the left. And so a lot of the change in tempo that Brentford have, right, relies on two players right now. Onyeka on the right central midfield, as well as his substitute, Yarmolyuk. So it's basically these two players that can so-called make the difference, because Wissa is basically waiting at the far post. Maupai is dropping too deep just to set up Yanel bursting forward. And, well, it will take time. Brentford usually takes about 2 to 3 games whenever they lose a key player, right? Think of when they lost Tony and then
Henry.
When they lost Rico Henry, yes, exactly. So, you know, they take like 2 to 3 games to figure out a new plan of attack. And so far, it's like 50-50 between their left flank of Yanel and their central midfield, which is based on Yarmolyuk, pretty much. But again, you know, no one's that interested. I think more important is how we target Sheffield United under Chris Wilder. Oh, man. Chris Wilder brought in a name from the cold, which nobody, not even myself, literally nobody has heard of. Brooks, not the Bournemouth Brooks, Andre Brooks, 20-year-old Andre Brooks, just randomly shoved in the middle of Archer and Osula and Hamer. It's just like, what is a young Brooks doing there? And really, his role is to just plug up whatever gaps Sheffield United's midfield leaves behind. Because right now, Sheffield United's plan is basically to lump the ball up and use their forwards to press whatever weaknesses opponents have. This is basically Cameron Archer's star role. He is like the hustler of the entire team, and he's so flexible that Archer can win the ball on the left flank, he can win it as center forward, he can win it on the right side. So whatever formation Wilder used throughout the match itself, I think he changed formations like twice. Archer was the only constant. He brought off Osula, he brought off a lot of other players, and I think if Sheffield United were to turn their fortunes around under new manager, because everyone's expecting new manager bounce, right? Cameron Archer is going to be at the center of everything. Who profits, I don't know, but it's definitely going to be Cameron Archer as the chief supplier. But how you target Sheffield United is basically same team, same problems. They still have issues dealing with spaces between the lines. Once Brentford beat their central midfield, they had oceans of space running at the back four. Brentford just couldn't punish them because, well, they don't have a number 9, right? So, yeah. But the space is there for people to use.
So was that it? Was it because I want to touch on two things just quickly here, because there isn't much to discuss from an FPL perspective here, unless obviously we're targeting them, and we'll get to that in tomorrow's matchup show. But the first thing is I think you're right. Thomas Frank is slow, or the team itself is slow to adjust when experiencing, you know, significant changes, to be it through injury or whatever, or suspension or whatever. But I have to say, with that midfield, Frank has played this kind of like press in central midfield before, and I don't understand why he didn't play it in this one, especially given that the youngster Andre Brooks was deputizing in there in Wilder's midfield five. I guess it was kind of like a 4-5-1. So I guess like you don't have them outnumbered, but you have them outgunned in terms of quality. So why like press in there and then send Wissa? Like, you know, Maupay is perfectly positioned. You play him at the nine. He's a pain in the ass. He's a pest, which is what he should be doing, right? He should be like eskering the opponent. But Maupay shifted to the left, and he dropped deep. And then he crowds Wissa when he shifts to the left. So I thought there were some tactical elements. I really failed Brentford here. And Thomas Frank is too slow. These are just, I think, basic things. The other thing I'll say is, I agree on how important Cameron Archer is. I don't want to see him at left midfield. If you want him for that press, if you want to lump the ball forward and then send the press, then put him at the nine instead of Osula. That was a little confusing to me. Maybe it was a player personnel. Maybe that they didn't have the depth for that left midfield spot. I'm not really sure. I don't know the team well enough. But that's just more rather than a criticism. That's just a question I would ask: is why not Cameron Archer at the nine? Why at left midfield? Here we go. This one's for you. Wolves against Forest. A 1-1 tie. Disappointingly for Wolves. Wolves 1.17 XG, Forest 1.29. Wolves with 68% possession, but really not many shots, not much happening in this one. Talk to us. What would you see here?
Well, I think the first major change that Forest did that changed literally in the entire game was that he dropped Dominguez. I think Dominguez was unavailable for this match. So they played Chick Kouyaté? I keep forgetting his first name, but the really tall, experienced one. Kouyaté played in left central midfield for Forest. That is, well, okay, put it this way. Wolves have a long history of losing against Palace, or at least teams that have Kouyaté playing in them, because he's just unmanageable. So, yes, he was a menace here, and Forest deservedly took the lead through that side. So, the problem here is that on top of having Kouyaté on the left side, Forest also reverted to their 3-5-2, and they played a completely new right wing back, Neco Williams, which, again, I absolutely love. But it just happened to be against Wolves, and Williams created the opener for Forest. So I'm just like, anyway, the question came down to whether Wolves could respond. And right now, as it stands, Cunha is in the middle, Huang is on the left, and Sarabia played on the right. This is going to continue changing, because right now, I wouldn't say we don't know who our best players are, but it's more of how Cunha determines where we play. So the Sarabia thing is basically him earning his spot over the likes of Bellegarde and anyone else, because Sarabia's movement over the last few games has been fantastic. Like the way he occupies centre-backs, the way he pulls them wide. And it just so happens that Cunha used the space left by Sarabia. You know, there's that cohesion now between that front three. And I'm very glad that it's not just Cunha and Huang. Sorry about that. My issue is that the pressure was not consistent. Because even though I think it's about fitness concerns, Wolves did not persist with their strategy for the entire 90 minutes despite having the upper hand. And we just saw the lack of depth, right? Like when Bueno ran out of steam, they had to bring on Matt Doherty, and that really killed a lot of our chances. When Sarabia ran out of fitness, we play a Bellegarde, who is okay, but he just brings down the whole tempo of the match because Bellegarde has to dribble himself. So I think in terms of having a Wolves attacker, just don't expect multiple returns. You know, a Cunha goal with some bonus is reasonably what you expect. And pretty much really good anyway for a player that's worth 5.5 million. So, yeah, you know, that just manage your expectations when investing in Wolves. For Forest, well, slides here says that Ilanga could punish Wolves on the Wolves right side on the counter. And Ilanga did have a decent shot. You know, it just so happens that because Forrest played 3-5-2, Ilanga had to be one of the center forwards alongside Morgan Gibbs-White. So he had to alternate himself between left and right. And that's disappointing because I think with Forrest, we just have to put that tagline on them. The only constant is change. Yeah, they just don't have a settled 11 right now. And yeah, we there's just no way we can use matchups or zonals or data even to try and predict how Forest will behave.
Yeah, and I believe I liked Ilanga in this one, and then it didn't come to pass precisely because I think because of the change in formation. But I feel like, and this is why, you know, the process over a product, right? So whereas in this one, Ilanga didn't get anything. But Nico Williams did get something from that side. He got the assist, right? And he had a solid game. And I know a lot of people are looking at defenders this game week. Obviously, Nico Williams is not nailed by any means, and he's a risk and all that. But if he's in a wing back role, he could definitely get you something here. I agree. Sarabia's movement has been stellar, and kind of the impetus for Wolves' goals in the past couple of games, Huang's goal in game week 15, and then Cunha's goal in game week 16. Sarabia has been playing well, so good to see him getting some starts. Moving on, Aston Villa Arsenal, the one everyone's been waiting for, especially our friend Nima, who's in the chat there. So let's give them a show about this one. Obviously, Aston Villa 1, Arsenal 0. Aston Villa 0.57 XG, Arsenal 1.4 XG, Arsenal 61% possession. What do you got for us? How did Villa let's knock down the two giants in City and Arsenal 1-0 in the past two game weeks at home? At Villa at home, they're just beasts. How do they do it?
I think let's start with Arsenal, because unlike Man City, to Arsenal's credit, Arsenal did generate a lot of chances prior to Villa taking the lead. I think, like, I was tearing my hair out watching all the shots that Odegaard missed. Because, remember, 2 weeks ago, right, I sold Martinelli for Odegaard in this particular case. And it was just amazing. It's like you said, Odegaard drops deep to help progress the ball forward. And understandably, Bukayo Saka cannot beat two Villa defenders on his own, right? Because Villa are actually pretty good in defense. So they rely on Odegaard to get into the box. So it's the same thing where I think they fielded Kai Havertz at left central midfield instead of Leandro Trossard. So yeah, Kai Havertz got into a lot of good positions himself, and really all these chances just fell for Odegaard and he couldn't finish, no matter where they created from. I think the good news here, as you've mentioned, I think on Twitter recently, like Arsenal discovered their left. And Martinelli links pretty well with Kai Havertz down that left side. They don't need Zinchenko inverting that much because the two of them are working pretty well up front right now. That's good news for Kai Havertz fans. I mean, I think, yeah, he's gone way too much stick for his own good. But yeah, let's hope that the mid-20s is when Kai Havertz hits his prime, so to speak. Anyway, that aside, Villa. Well, I think we have to give a lot of credit to Youri Tielemans here, because he has filled a certain role that makes teams difficult to predict. It's like Tielemans playing left wing shifts McGinn to the right, shifts Bailey up front. And then Tielemans returning to central midfield shifts Bailey to the right and shifts McGinn to the left. So, yeah, Youri Tielemans is just so good at overloading zones to bypass Arsenal's midfield. So they took a page out of Luton's book, because they figured out, right, they noticed that Ross Barkley could actually beat multiple Arsenal players when they lost to Arsenal narrowly 4-3. And they basically use Tielemans to work with certain midfielders in certain zones to just bypass that Arsenal pressure and then release Bailey. That's it. Like, beat the Arsenal midfield, release Bailey. Beat the Arsenal midfield, release Bailey. And Villa didn't have to do it too many times because once they took the lead, they just sat back, really. So the story really is about how Arsenal failed to break down the Villa defense more than Villa really smashing Arsenal. It has to be said, though, that I understand that a lot of people are going to be very interested in Aston Villa, given that they play Luton in game week 18, right, when everyone blanks. So Watkins is going to be in there. We just have to understand that Watkins is not going to be the volume player that that we all knew he once was. When he came up, right, playing for Brentford, Watkins used to take a lot of shots in a particular match. And here, he's resulted... He's basically cornered into this situation where if he doesn't take his one shot and he doesn't get the one goal from his one shot, he's stuck. But if he gets an early goal, he's very likely going to go on to get a hat-trick. So it's largely based on game state. But I think owning Watkins is like a must for the foreseeable future, especially with Haaland's, you know, rumored injury and whatnot. But for the supporting cast, I mean, barely anybody lasts 90 minutes now, right? Neither Bailey nor Diaby nor... Like, I think McGinn is the only one that's roaming from position to position. And now with Jacob Ramsey back... Jacob Ramsey back, yeah, it's going to be an even more mysterious rotation policy for Unai Emery's Villa side. I wish I could recommend somebody.
I do have a question for you, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but I wanted to get your perspective since you won't be on the show tomorrow. What is, in your opinion, Cash's role to this Villa side? Because I'll get into the details tomorrow of Diego Carlos being healthy and Konsa's right back and all of that, but I just wanted to get your perspective on it all.
Well, Matty Cash is good if there is a direct runner behind opposition fullbacks. I think Villa gave a lot of respect to Zinchenko on the left side, and they actually deliberately targeted Ben White. Like, they even had John McGinn intentionally pull Ben White all the way to centre back so that McGinn had the full liberty of choosing which side of Ben White he wanted to turn against. So Matty Cash is going to be a player that works typically with Diaby. I think Cash and Bailey is going to have a bit of a clash because Cash is able to play, you know, those diagonal passes into half spaces, but he is not good at playing through balls. So it's a bit of a clash of play styles where Cash works a lot better with Diaby running centrally towards the box rather than Bailey moving out wide. And that's why Cash looked extremely good in Villa's 3-5-2 setup because, when you have two forwards to aim at and Cash is absolutely glowing. But when you have to aim for wingers down the flanks, Cash himself doesn't know what to do once he passes the ball to Bailey. He just sits there outside the box. He's like, okay, give it to me. And he knows the ball's not coming back. So he's just like, okay, I'll just wait here and let Leon Bailey do his thing. Yeah.
All right. We will get more into that tomorrow Wednesday on the matchups show. In about 48 hours or 47 and a half hours from 48 and a half hours from now. So definitely stay tuned for that. While I'm taking a moment to mention that we are at approaching 40 minutes here soon. Make sure you smash that like. Thank you for being with us here in the chat. Colm's cooking up some dinner right now while he listens to us. Happy family, cozy holiday time. So nice to have you all. Everton, Chelsea. I want to know mostly how people see Sean Dyche. Both Everton, Fulham, Bournemouth. He's been showing us so much recently. Obviously, the score ended Everton 2, Chelsea nothing. Chelsea 0.95 XG, Everton 1.22 XG. Chelsea 72% possession, 16 shots, only 4 shots on target. They had 6 blocked shots. So that part of Dyche's DNA still is still there. How did you see this match?
I think, okay, so I think we have to give credit to Sean Dyche of morphing the briefing he gives his wingers. So over the last four games, like 4 games ago, when we talk about Everton, right, we always assume that both players, both wide players, McNeil and Harrison, would stick to the flanks and they would basically attack through the flanks. So we would say that the wingers typically attack fullbacks. In this particular game, though, when Harrison went down the right, McNeil was waiting in the center, and vice versa. When McNeil attacked down the left, Harrison was actually waiting like centrally on the edge of the penalty area. So I think Sean Dyche changed his plan for this because he knew. He knew that Chelsea's defensive midfielders are more likely to be dragged out wide, leaving a lot of space in the center. So Everton got a lot of early shots that way. I think more damning is the fact that Chelsea's central midfield right now, no matter what combination of central midfielders they play, is extremely naive defensively. Yeah, they just assume that, you know, there's no one to follow up with the second ball. And Chelsea were basically caught cold with both goals, like, you know, the early and the late one. So really, the story that everyone wants to know, right, is Cole Palmer worth buying? Answer is yes. He did play assister to the assister role in this particular game. You know, like if you assume that all of Chelsea's chances manifested in goals, then you would say that Cole Palmer would be assister to the assister. Because say what you want, Cole Palmer is the difference. That he has that final through ball that releases players and it comes down to his teammates finishing. Like, I think the amount of times he released Mudrik, right, to go up against Ashley Young was just like, yeah, and Pedersen for that matter. Disappointing though for me was the fact that nobody took advantage of that matchup. I think Jackson, when he came on for Broya, did make a little bit, like he did offer a little bit of help down that left side, but Jackson himself, well, if you don't start games with Jackson, I think he comes on pretty rusty. Now we know. But yeah, Jackson needs a run of games to feature and do well. I mean, I wish I could comment more about Chelsea, but when you don't start Sterling and Jackson, you feel a completely different side. And I can only say that, yeah, Cole Palmer's the shining star, no matter what side you play. Enzo Fernandez is very wasteful, though. I can say that much, but I don't think anyone's interested.
No, I mean, I think it's only interesting in the sense, like, how does the team change with, like, Enzo Fernandez played a more advanced position and Conor Gallagher played behind, and how does that affect the players that you might be interested in? Honestly, I think there's a lot of chatter on Twitter and, like, people thinking, like, should I bring Raheem Sterling in? And I think that's just absolute madness. Like, the team has shown no kind of cohesion, no system. Pochettino has really let this team down in terms of the development of the connections between the team. And you're going to go in, I mean, get Cole Palmer, he's cheap, but to double up and to get Raheem Sterling is, I think, a little bit insane.
I think I just like to add one last word. Gun to my head, if I were to pick somebody now who will make the difference against Sheffield United, Wolves, Palace, and Luton, and Fulham for that matter, sorry, Combe, coming up ahead, I'd say Mudrik. I'd actually pick Mudrik to be the difference maker. So even though he's misfiring quite a bit, he is at least in the right positions where he can luck himself into an assist or a goal, you know, over the next few. Yeah, at least over the likes of Palmer and Sterling and Broya and Jackson.
So, I mean, you'd prefer Mudrik over Sterling?
Yeah, logically. Like, in terms of you looking at the process in which they attack.
Okay. But not over Cole Palmer, surely. Price, if we're factoring price and everything.
I mean, I just have to comment based on what I see. Palmer's going to be popular because of his price. If Mudrik were 5.5 million, I'd gladly take Mudrik any day.
Right. Okay, we'll move on to the next one here. 44 minutes in. I think our time is good. Here it is. The Combs game. This one's for you, Combs. Hopefully you're focusing more on the food. Don't burn that dinner that you're cooking. Fulham versus West Ham. Fulham net XG 2.01. Highest of the game week, as we said. West Ham 1.24. This game obviously ended 5-0 in favor of Fulham. We have a saying in Venezuela. We say when it's 5-0, like if you're playing, we play futbolito, like on a basketball court, concrete basketball court, and if if the game reaches 5-0, then the team is out. It's 5-0 Zapatero, and you're not allowed to play anymore. Next team comes in, there's nothing you can do. So Fulham eliminates West Ham from the game with their 5-0 trouncing. I'm really curious to hear your perspective on this game. Super happy with the William pick that identified by matchups, but wondering if people are investing in Fulham, and I know a lot of people are thinking about it. I want to hear about those assets: Andres Pereira, Anthony Robinson, William, and Alex Iwobi. So what do you got for us?
Where do I start? I think Colm would have burnt his food by now because Fulham were literally fire, as the millennials would say. I strongly believe, Colm, please correct me if I'm wrong, if he were to pick one player out of that team that was the superstar, right, in the 5-0 drubbing here, I'm pretty convinced that he would pick Tom Kenny, because in that left central midfield role, Kenny linked everything so well together. I think his quality of passing on the ball has been underrated for so long that whenever he bombs up that left half space, he activates Willian, he links well with Andreas Pereira, and he has the capability of using Palinha even to find Raul Jimenez at the back post. So I think what we don't consider here is that West Ham themselves are extremely passive in defense. Like, This is something that we're going to talk about in the coming weeks. Like, whenever Moyes gets a win, it's only because nobody pressures their centre-backs. And Fulham pressed their centre-backs and their midfield so hard. I mean, there was a point where Suchek was in line with the centre-backs. So, I wouldn't say that West Ham have a poor defensive shape, but it really is about Suchek refusing to come out of his back line. And that just left Kenny and Palinha and even Raul Jimenez himself way too much space to dictate play. The primary beneficiary, though, if somebody were to punt on Fulham because they want to, you know, have somebody for a few weeks to replace Mbomo or something like that, Alex Iwobi is definitely the superstar on this particular team sheet. Because
I knew you were going to say Alex Iwobi.
Yeah, has to be because... he's been playing right central midfield, I think 4 weeks ago, but now he's playing on the right wing. And you mentioned in your slides that Iwobi went up against Emerson. Well, Iwobi started on the right, but Cresswell started on the left. And when Emerson came on half time, Willian was subbed off, shifting Iwobi to the left to go up against Soufal. So I'm sorry, Gabe, we just never saw that matchup happen. I'm sorry about that. No.
Managers trolling my matchups.
I know, right? So in the end, it was Harry Wilson that did the damage against Emerson here, because wow, Harry Wilson was fantastic himself. I think I mentioned this last game week, right? In the middle of your in the matchup shows that I crashed, Fulham are a team that develops their players, and every single player in the team is starting to gain a new dimension. Harry Wilson can have influence centrally as well as out wide. Iwobi is now playing central midfield as well as either flank. Raul is getting goals. Oh my gosh, Raul is getting goals. Never thought I'd see the day. And then you'd have the likes of Robinson and now Kenny coming into the fray. Fulham is just a team that has a solid core of 13 to 15 players improving day by day. And that is rare. That is rare. Mm. Often you just want the finished product to maximize their potential at the highest level of the game. But Fulham are improving. Fulham are improving. Beyond that, gun to my head, again, I pick Iwobi over Willian and Harry Wilson at the moment. But I'd say Harry Wilson would be second over Willian, as much as I like the Willian pick. Because even when Fulham got their second goal, it was because Iwobi took a shot. What's his face? Fabianski saved it. And then Andres Pereira followed up into the box, punishing the West Ham sluggishness and crossed for Willian's goal. So, I mean, Willian is there, but, you know, he's not like the chief creator or the chief chance taker of the entire squad.
Yeah, and you've mentioned Andres Pereira is the motor of that team before, so he will always be making that. He won't stop running, right? So if that ball's coming back, it will be him on it. And I have to say, Marco Silva, not enough people are talking about Marco Silva. You mentioned it, players developing and improving as individuals, and a team adding elements and layers game week by game week. I think Marco Silva and Iraola are just like really showing some tremendous managing right now. As a counterpoint, like to for example, Erik ten Hag and Pochettino, who are really failing at one, developing players, and two, developing a system that brings those players together. So we have kind of like some counterpoints of the managers at the big teams not doing great, and the managers at the small teams really showing what they can do. Go ahead.
Just a quick note on West Ham, because we've not mentioned them at all. Iwobi and Kudus alternated between right wing and center forward. So they started with Kudus at center forward and Bowen at right wing. And then towards the end, when West Ham needed more goals, they had Bowen as the poacher striker in the box. And he did get a couple of chances against Fulham, actually. They were just saved by superhero Leno.
Yeah, and I thought that was a massive mistake. I don't know what Kudus is doing at the nine, to be perfectly honest with you. I didn't understand that from Moyes, so I thought that was a tactical blunder on his part. I don't know if I would expect to see that again, because I just assume people are reasonable, but I don't know. We'll see. Definitely something to keep an eye on. Luton, Manchester City, the shock horror, no Haaland. Well, to everybody except for Andy Martin, of course, who saw this coming like back in July or something like that. So kudos to him and his insight. So I mean, obviously Manchester City got it done in the end with a 2-1 win. I loved Luton's goal. There was just something about it, just like the Andros Townsend, like the old school, like cutting it back on his left foot, and just like that, it was just a perfect curl. It's just a perfect curl. And Adebayo jumped like he wasn't running at it. It was just like straight up. It was like a post rose, and it just bounced off the post. And it was great. I enjoyed that kind of old school goal. Talk to us about this game.
I've never seen Ruben Dias so dominated in the air. It's strange. Owned. I mean, yeah, Luton are the new definition of a cold, wet night in Stoke, aren't they? There's so much physicality, and there's just like, okay, so whenever you deal with a physical team like Luton, right, the first thing you need to do is bypass the pressure they put on you. I think there was this one particular chance where Lockyer, I think, tracked Julian Alvarez all the way into deep midfield, like really, really deep midfield. And Julian Alvarez just turned and poked the ball into space. All of a sudden, I think it was Foden and Bernardo Silva having a 2v2 counterattack against Luton's two remaining centre-backs. So as long as you can handle the physical pressure that Luton puts on you, then yeah, you do okay. You do okay. So I think that's where Liverpool were naive when they visited. And this is where, Man City did well. Because in the end, well, City demonstrated a bit of physicality themselves, right? When push comes to shove, Rodri is the superhero. So yeah, he just charges forward, right? Rodri just is so good at using his physical presence to charge forward, and literally nobody stops him. Well, actually, the goal came about because two Luton players had to crowd him out, and Bernardo Silva just, you know, pounced on the loose ball. But I think that's where City, you know, get things done, right? They have this extra guile compared to the rest of the league, where they can play beautiful technical football, but if they need to win ugly, they will win ugly somehow, some way. But yes, if I were to comment on your slides, I mean, I think the disappointing thing was that City showed a lot of possession without penetration, right? Especially without Haaland. They played Kovacic in deep midfield alongside Rodri, which meant that you had Julian Alvarez, Bernardo Silva, and Phil Foden basically flitting between the lines, just trying to figure out when to receive the ball. And when they did receive the ball, the Luton centre-backs were just, you know, pressing up so high on them that they barely had time to breathe. So I think the question comes down to, when Luton play Bournemouth up next, right? Are we expecting the centre backs to press Solanke the same way? Because if you ask me, I'd happily say so. Happily say so. Especially with Lockyer in there. Lockyer against Solanke is going to be like the wrestling match of this coming game week. But this in turn releases Semenyo. It releases Tavernier. Maybe Sinisterra even, right? That's going to be the real superstar of the game if Bournemouth were to break past the Luton back line. Yeah, but as for Man City, we know now that if you have a big physical striker that can trouble their centre-backs, then yeah, by all means, go for it, right? City, I think this isn't the first goal that City have conceded in the air. So, I mean, we're not expecting Palace to do it, but yeah, that's definitely a reason not to buy City defence as of now.
Okay, we're at 55 minutes, so only 5 minutes left in the show. We have one more fixture to get to, but really quickly before we get to that fixture, I wanted to ask you your opinion on the past two matches. Manchester City have really struggled to, like you said, to penetrate with the ball. All possession, no penetration. We see the average position maps there against Villa. Now, granted, against Villa, they had no Rodri, so you could attribute it to that. Why, really quickly, why did they fail to penetrate against Luton?
Because they have nobody stretching the Luton lines. They literally had nobody running behind Luton. They need somebody to actually like pin Luton back. Any side that does well against Luton needs a number nine, threatening at least, to run behind Luton so that Luton cannot press them all the way in the midfield.
Okay. Good. All right, last one here. Tottenham destroying Newcastle. Tottenham... Oh man, that goal at the end kind of hurt my minus eight. But Tottenham 4, Newcastle 1, Tottenham 3.81 XG, Newcastle 1.69, Tottenham 23 shots, 12 shots on target. I mean, this is quite the dominant performance, and Newcastle has really shown some frailty away, and they obviously they're just battered and bruised and tired and all of that. We got about 2 minutes for this one. What can you say?
Well, I think Newcastle did have some influence in the first half before the score got really ugly. But yeah, a lot of Newcastle's play went down Anthony Gordon's side, and he actually had a lot of space. I mean, okay, wait. Let's talk about where the space is attacking Spurs, because right now, I mean, Pedro Porro and Udogie were the stars in attack. But defensively, when Spurs lost the ball, especially when Bissouma and Saar did weird things, there was so much space on the flanks. Like, I think, remember when Spurs lost, like, what, 4-1 to Chelsea or something like that? 4-0 to Chelsea?
The two red cards.
Yeah, the two red cards, right? And then they had, like, literally their entire defense on the halfway line, and they just needed somebody to sprint behind them. Exactly the same case. Gordon just sat on the halfway line, waited for the long ball, and went through. So Newcastle did have chances to take the lead, and if not for some wonderful interventions from Ben Davis, Newcastle should have led that game, arguably at halftime. But yes, Spurs. Well, when you isolate Son against Trippier, like, I don't know whose fault that is, because I don't foresee a Newcastle winger tracking back to double up against Son. So it really is a calculated risk that Newcastle take. So, full credit to Spurs because, yeah, Son did the damage. Like, from it was 1-0 until Son started taking Trippier on. And from 1-0, it went to 3-0 really fast. Simple as that. So credit to Son for making the matchup count, especially with Richarlison in there. And that was it. At 3-0, Newcastle just took too many risks.
Yeah. And I'll just quickly add that I thought Spurs... Or not Spurs, Newcastle. Trippier got no help from his center mids. The center mids were shifted over to the left a little bit, and he was left quite isolated there on that right hand side versus Son. So I thought that was a tactical blunder by Howe. We don't see many by him. He's been tactically just really really good and adaptable, and so I thought that was a bit of a tactical mistake there. And then this game just got away from them, like you said. Cool. We are at it. And then just a quick review of the captaincy metric. Haaland was top. Obviously, he didn't play. Mbomo was second. Obviously, he didn't play. And then it was Watkins. And I know one of the haulers, Nick Khan, put his vice captain on Watkins because of this metric, unfortunately. So that's a shame. Shame for him. But yeah, the captaincy metric did not work out this week, unfortunately. We'll see what Mariner has in store for us on Wednesday. Thank you to the haulers. Not going to read them all out on this show because this is a time-limited show. We're going to get this one out as quickly as possible. Just wanted to say thank you. Super haulers, haulers, we love you. We will thank you individually on Wednesday in the main show. And that'll do it with Cunha Salah and Tavernier. Is that Tavernier? Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
And Tavernier here on the slide. Loving that. Thank you, everybody in the chat. L. Ron Cupboard. And I do have to say, Borro will get a haul soon. The guy is everywhere. I love what he's doing. Super happy with that pick. Counting down here to the 60 minutes. Let's get out of here, Lucien. Thank you so much for all your hard work and your help. It's good to see you as always. Thank you to everyone in the chat. Thank you, haulers. And talk to you in 2 days. Bye. Peace.